These two big changes in my career were instigated by phone calls that I had no idea were coming. I immediately accepted the life changes offered in the phone calls. In retrospect, I had no idea how large a change was to come. Each started out as just another everyday occurrence. There were no agonizing decisions, no long-term life plans, nothing other than the ordinary flow of my life. I was not looking for change, and would probably have had a fulfilling and rich life without those changes. Happily, they were more than satisfying. Looking back and thinking about those phone calls, I realized that I could have just as easily said no to both of them, and in doing so, missed two of the most gratifying developments in my professional life. Life is full of junctures and opportunities, and it is impossible to know in advance which way to go and which chances to take. I feel very lucky that I said yes to these opportunities. The blessing of work. Much has been written about automation and the replacement of human workers with machines. Two main justifications are usually given for mechanizing jobs once done by humans. First, that the work is tedious and dangerous, so it's better to let machines do it for the workers' sake. And second, that workers are expensive and unreliable, so machines can save money while retaining or improving quality. These ideas are basically derived from the context of blue-collar factory work. They do little to address the computer revolution and the great changes that have occurred across the workforce, replacing a large number of highly trained and educated scientific and technical workers with machines. This trend toward more and more automation brings into play the question of what meaning we give to work. The current situation was in some ways anticipated by writers as far back as the earliest days of the Industrial Revolution. One of the most prescient books in this genre was written by Kurt Vonnegut right after World War II. In Player Piano, he describes a future America where the majority of the people are either unemployed or working in highly alienating jobs, in a desultory army, or doing meaningless public works projects. And these people live across a river. It could just as well be the other side of the tracks or highway, from a small, educated elite that runs the economy. In this society, machines do most of the work, and the jobs left for the majority of the human population provide no satisfaction. A more nuanced understanding of the changes brought about by the way people choose to develop technology can be found in Harry Braverman's scholarly treatise titled Labor and Monopoly Capital. Braverman points out that work that allows for self-expression satisfies human need, and he traces the roots of the trend toward de-skilling of both work and workers. In Braverman's terms, the machines that enhance people's skills are considered life-supporting, while those that de-skill people and devalue their work are life-destroying. Perhaps the best spokesperson for the need to define the proper role of machines is Mahatma Gandhi. Asked whether he was opposed to machines, he answered, "How can I be when I know that even this body is the most delicate piece of machinery? A spinning wheel is a machine, a little toothpick is a machine. What I object to is the craze for machinery, not machinery as such. The craze is for what they call labor-saving machinery. Men go on saving labor till thousands are without work and thrown on the open streets to die of starvation. I want to save time and labor, not for a fraction of mankind, but for all. I want the concentration of wealth, not in the hands of a few, but in the hands of all. Today, machinery merely helps a few ride on the backs of millions." The issues raised by Braverman and Gandhi are eloquently reinforced by E.F. Schumacher, who looks at work from a Buddhist point of view. In his classic essay titled Buddhist Economics, Schumacher points out that work serves to feed our basic need for association with other people. In fact, work supplies several of our basic human needs, such as 1. It gives people a chance to utilize and develop their faculties. 2. It enables people to overcome their ego-centeredness by joining with others in a common task. And 3. It brings forth the goods and services for a becoming existence. With this in mind, Schumacher points out that work is a basic human function that transcends the usual economic meanings associated with it. He writes, "To organize work in such a manner that it becomes meaningless, boring, stultifying, or nerve-wracking for the worker would be little short of criminal. It would indicate a greater concern with goods than with people, an evil lack of compassion, and a soul-destroying degree of attachment to the most primitive side of this worldly existence. Equally, to strive for leisure as an alternative to work would be a complete misunderstanding of one of the basic truths of human existence, namely, that work and leisure are complementary parts of the same living process and cannot be separated without destroying the joy of work and the bliss of leisure." If I am inspired by the humanity and beauty of Schumacher's description of the Buddhist conception of what is called right livelihood, where does that leave me in terms of the current conditions in my own society? The answer for me comes from a strange place. I found it in Lawrence Weschler's book titled Seeing is Forgetting the Name of the Thing One Sees, an examination of the life and work of the contemporary artist Robert Irwin. What is unusual and inspiring about Irwin is the experimentation he brought to exploring the boundaries of his craft. To me, Irwin's journey is a model for anyone in any walk of life. Take control over your life and work, it tells us. Instead of following the normal course of his profession, Irwin followed his curiosity and created a unique path of exploration and wonderment that provided a life force based on self-expression. At least two things happen to most students who read Irwin's biography. First, and most important, they realize that they do not need to stay within the bounds of their profession as taught in school or practiced by their peers. Second, they learn about perception, which is, for most of them, a useful new way of seeing the world. As the title says, seeing is forgetting the name of the thing one sees. Even those who stay in the system can make meaningful choices that support their principles and set them apart from their professional colleagues. Some people, for example, myself included, do not, as a matter of principle, do military work. Others choose to work on social betterment projects. More telling than the choice of work is an individual's attitude toward and relationship to his work. Many people associate the freedom to make such choices only with highly skilled professional work. My experience is that such choices are available even in the most seemingly menial jobs. I worked my way through school with various jobs. I have worked as a gas station attendant, a riveter, a handyman, a warehouse hauler, a door-to-door salesman, a stock clerk, a delivery man, a street vendor, a postal clerk, a chicken farmer, an engineer, and a teacher. Was I any less intelligent or less of a person when I didn't have a PhD attached to my name? No matter what work any of us does or what background we come from, we get to decide how we see ourselves and the world. When you hold yourself in high esteem and keep a positive outlook on your future, others usually follow suit. By choosing the meaning we give to the people and things in our environment, ultimately we control our own experiences, no matter what work we are doing. Fulfilling others' expectations. One of the hardest things can be to follow a path that's different from what your family or society expects of you. It's very possible that you are expected to join the family business, or have the same career and life trajectory as your parents. And maybe that would make you happy, and maybe it wouldn't. When I grew up in the Bronx, my friend Mark got a lot of pressure from his parents because he was not paying attention to his schoolwork. He spent all of his time on the street, fixing cars. They insisted he go to a counselor who put him through a battery of tests. The results showed that he had an aptitude for doing things with his hands. He ended up moving to a small town where he opened a printing business and lived happily ever after. Like Mark, many of us do have a sense as to what kinds of things we are good at and what naturally appeals to us. Yet we are surrounded by well-meaning people like Mark's parents who have formed ideas about what is the best path for us. The two idea streams are often in conflict. When my wife Ruth was in school, her parents insisted that she study something marketable, like secretarial or teaching skills, instead of doing the artistic and creative problem-solving work she was born for. This pressure led to a wrong professional choice, and it took many years for her to get on the proper path. Sometimes, though, you can be lucky and have a protector. Andy was my closest friend in graduate school. During his funeral, in a very moving eulogy, his nephew tearfully expressed his gratitude. The nephew, now a successful architect, felt deeply indebted to Andy for having taken him in and supported his studies in architecture after his own father disowned him for deciding not to go into the family business. Mark, Ruth, and Andy's nephew all faced conflicts about career path choices. Such issues are very common for college students. Even without outside constraints, it's not uncommon for people to change their choices in midstream. Some do it several times. Others spend most of their working lives hunting for the right career, and some drop out completely. Often when I speak with students, I explain to them that many people, even very successful ones, do not know what they will do when they grow up. It's all part of the adventure of life, and the best thing is to enjoy the voyage. The constraints on our career paths tend to be self-imposed. It is said that we all rise to our level of incompetence. I can't say that I have found much truth in that. What I find more to be the case is that we tend to rise without thinking. There is a ladder that exists in many career paths, and society brainwashes people to think they are supposed to climb it. Not every new award, degree, or promotion is a good thing for the individual. There are a great many X-somethings floating around who would have led much more satisfying and productive lives if they had stayed in the trenches, doing what they really enjoyed, rather than moving in what looked like an upward direction. A woman named Diane spent many years as a nurse before getting promoted to supervisor and then to administrator. It was a lot more money and power, yet she realized that she wasn't helping anybody anymore, and quit. Being so far removed from the patients she cared about had killed her enthusiasm for the job. Now she's a martial arts instructor instead. If in doubt, go back to the earlier exercise where you asked yourself three questions. Who am I? What do I want? What is my purpose? It's a good idea to revisit that exercise frequently. Now I'd like you to do it once more and add a new word. What do I really want? Keep asking it, over and over, until you feel you have gained insight into your own desires, so you're no longer at the mercy of society's ideas of what is good for you. What we take for granted. The most important things we can know about a man are the things he takes for granted, and the most important things to know about a society are those which are simply assumed and seldom noticed. Lewis Worth. The things we take for granted and simply assume are the basis for our self-image and give the things in our lives their meaning. By making our background assumptions explicit, we are able to affirm them or change them. Doing this gives us the opportunity to change ourselves from puppets to truly autonomous beings. Some people achieve autonomy through sheer stubbornness and rebelliousness. Although that may work, it's not a healthy way to approach change. A more rational approach is to look at everything that is obvious to you. Your turn. Make a list of all the things in your life that you do not normally notice. A good heading for such a list is things that are too obvious or too trivial to list. For example, your list might include the following. 1. I don't really listen when my wife talks to me. 2. I will never clean out the garage. 3. I do not get enough sleep. 4. I never seem to get around to phoning my cousin. 5. I always support the same political party that my parents did. And 6. My attitude toward money is the same as my father's. In the coming days, notice how much of your behavior is based on items on this list. If you are happy with these things, go on with your life. If you want to change any of them, cross them out on the list, both actually and metaphorically. One of the things I very much like about problem statements in the form of points of view, which we discussed in Chapter 3, is that the POV statement tends to reveal underlying assumptions and make the desired objectives explicit. Formerly, many people operated on the basis of unspoken and unnoticed assumptions. Now, with POV, more assumptions are stated explicitly. Unfortunately, countless assumptions still go unnoticed and may in fact unnecessarily bias the solution. The role unquestioned assumptions play becomes obvious if we look back at sociopolitical norms of the past, things like the absolute power of royalty, political participation only for men, property passed to the eldest son, slavery, serfdom, a prohibition on divorce, only men being allowed to file for divorce, only property holders being allowed to vote, child labor, colonization, and the white man's burden. For a long time, each of these was assumed to be an intrinsic part of the given culture and passed unnoticed and uncontested until its presence was brought into the foreground and its legitimacy questioned. A parable that nicely illustrates the relativistic nature of our social norms is the story of the young man who walked into a small town dressed only in a white sheet and did not speak except for babbling sounds. The townspeople assumed the poor fellow was insane and locked him up in their mental hospital. A week later, 20 more people walked into town, dressed identically in white sheets and babbling in the same way as the original fellow. At this point, the townspeople released the first man. Clearly, he was part of a religious sect. The overriding message here is that if you are going to do something outlandish, you had better get a group together, otherwise people will think you're crazy. Many institutions in our society are widely accepted, and yet if you looked at them within the white sheet babbling framework, they would make no sense if there weren't a lot of people participating in them. Imagine what would happen if there were no universities, and I approached you on the street and suggested that you pay me a lot of money for at least 4 years. In return, I would give you lectures on subjects you have never heard of, that I happen to be interested in, and if you jump through enough hoops, at the end of the 4 years, I would give you a piece of paper with your name on it. Let's call it a BS. Would that sound reasonable? I once heard an Indian guru give a parable describing the history of banking. A man was sitting on his front porch watching the world go by when suddenly he got a vision consisting of four letters, B, A, N, and K. So he got a piece of chalk and wrote the letters on his front door. Shortly thereafter, someone came up to him and gave him some money. The man was surprised and perplexed, so he put the money in a large box. All day long, people kept giving him money, and he kept being perplexed and putting the money into the box. Finally, at the end of the day, the man went into his house and took all his money out from under his mattress and put it in the same box. The story was told to warn the guru's followers about self-delusion and false prophets. It makes the point that if enough people do it, it stops being crazy and instead becomes the accepted norm. The famous tulip, stock market, dot-com, and housing bubbles are just the tip of the iceberg for this type of me-too behavior. Unfortunately, this tendency to relabel the crazy as normal doesn't apply only to financial situations. It is also at the heart of some of the world's greatest political and social conflicts. In the many ongoing conflicts between people and nations, each side justifies itself by pointing out some wrong done to it by the other side. Each side's story makes perfect sense and justifies whatever they do in response. The interesting thing that often goes unnoticed is that the justification depends on where they start the story. I call this a question of punctuation, and although it goes unacknowledged by the belligerents, it is of utmost importance. History is an ongoing flow. For all practical purposes, other than in our individual lives, there is no beginning or end. So all stories that are told with a beginning are distortions of what has happened. Where the story starts colors it so as to justify the storyteller's position. The ongoing slaughter between Muslims and Hindus did not start with who threw the first stone after the Indian subcontinent's partition. The trouble in your marriage did not start when your wife went out with her ex-boyfriend or your husband did not clean the garage. By deciding where to start the story or where to put the period, You give the story its meaning. By changing the punctuation, you can make the hero into the villain, and vice versa. The problem is that most of us are too busy seeing all the babbling sheets around us. If that is all we see, it becomes very difficult for us to see that we and our fellows are not acting like autonomous, reasonable, rational beings. In many ways, our self-image is intimately related to what we choose as our identity. We often hold a few items so strongly that we lose our autonomy and in effect become puppets. These items should certainly be on your list of things that are too obvious or too trivial to list. If you are willing to cut the puppeteer strings while still holding on to your identity, you might free yourself to rewrite your conflict stories with different punctuation. Sometimes you're going to screw up. Somewhere along the way, all of us will screw up. Some of us will screw up more than others. It's just plain going to happen. You'll fudge something on a resume and get caught. You'll say something insulting about your boss and find out he's within earshot. You'll accept credit for something that was really someone else's idea. You'll sneak into work late and pretend you were there all along. Here's the thing. Presidents Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton both screwed up. Yet what got them into real trouble wasn't the original sin. It was the lies they told afterward. Had each of them fessed up, their troubles would most likely have blown over much faster. Instead, we remember, "I am not a crook," and "I did not have sexual relations with that woman," as punchlines. Lies can snowball. You tell one, and then you have to tell another to back it up. When you feel painted into a corner, there's a good solution. Tell the truth. It's uncomfortable, and you may get into trouble, yet it will almost certainly be less trouble than if you compound the issue by lying again. When you get caught with your hand in the cookie jar, don't cover up. Fess up. Sometimes we can get so caught up in the minutiae of our lives that we forget to step back and see the bigger possibilities out there for us. If you've been following a conservative path, why not take a chance and veer off it for a while? Change your surroundings. Agree to a friend's crazy plan. Tag along on a cross-country trip. Learn about communities different from your own and figure out where you fit in. Remember that the real big picture is this. You don't take anything with you when you die, so you might as well spend your time on Earth experiencing all that you can, rather than stagnating and accumulating. Make achievement your habit. Chapter 10. Hardening of the categories leads to art disease. Kenneth Snelson. I take the view that life is basically a problem-solving activity, and you can learn to make both the process and the result better. My goal with this book has been to give you tools and concepts that you can use to achieve a fuller, more fruitful, more satisfying life. Problems are good for you. The word problem has negative connotations. It implies there is something wrong that needs fixing. However, if a problem is reframed as an opportunity to make things in our life better, then it becomes a positive, and problem-solving can be recognized as one of our basic life forces. Some enlightened individuals think of all problems as opportunities. Still, you don't have to wait for enlightenment to realize the positive influence problems can have in your life. You can just look at your own experience. When I'm working on a problem, it can take over my life. I find it hard to go to sleep, and I wake up early, excited to deal with it. In his classic 19th-century Russian novel, Ivan Goncharov creates the anti-hero Ilya Ilyich Oblomov, the ultimate embodiment of a superfluous person. Oblomov is incapable of making a decision or undertaking any significant action. He has no real problems, so he rarely leaves his bed. In fact, he fails to leave his bed for the first 150 pages of the novel. This is a fictitious story that, in its time, was meant to parody the life of idle aristocrats. It represents for me a portrait of what happens in life without problems. It reaffirms my experience that problems, like satisfying work, are gifts that provide vehicles for the natural development of our life-giving forces. So, what are problems? I use the word problem to describe any situation that we want to change. Usually, problems are stated as questions. How do I get a job? Or statements. I cannot afford college. Generally, we want to deal with problems in order to effect a positive change in some situation. Life consists of solving a series of problems. We are nearly all very good at it. We learn by repetition, and to a great extent, are not consciously aware of our abilities. Most people dress themselves suitably on a daily basis, make their way to their destinations, and accomplish basic tasks such as feeding themselves. Furthermore, they manage all this within their environmental, cultural, and economic constraints. In addition to this daily onslaught of success, we also find frustrations and failures. We all have unsolved issues in our lives. There are situations and people that bug us, and there are vexing personal and professional problems. It's often easy to resolve these issues by applying the simple techniques described in Chapter 3. I've employed these techniques in my own life and share them with many groups throughout the world. If you reframe your problem, many possible options become apparent, and the path to a solution often becomes obvious. Once you have a clear view of what you want to accomplish, there are various ways to work out the details. Prototype your way to success. A prototype is a sample or model created to show or test a concept, something to be learned from. In solving problems, an excellent way to move forward is to incorporate prototyping into your process. Early in the problem-solving process, it's best to think of prototypes as simply trial balloons, ideas or statements sent out to gauge people's reactions to your ideas. Prototypes don't necessarily have to resemble a physical object. They can take any form. They could be conversations, written drafts, short movies, skits, physical embodiments of social or personal problems, or actual physical models of objects. Prototypes can be in any form that gives information. They don't need to look like or work like the final solution, and they certainly do not need to do both. In a culture of prototyping, things are always being tried out. The road to a final solution is strewn with ideas that have been prototyped as ways to get information, directions to take, ideas to modify, and ideas to abandon. Prototyping is a great way to show people what you have in mind, so you can elicit their feedback. When the result of prototyping is a physical object, it is usually best that it not be too precious. The term mock-up is sometimes used to denote an early-stage, non-precious prototype. I think the term crap-up would be a better way to describe the ideal early prototype. Your turn. The next time you're asked to do something, don't spend too much time thinking. Simply charge ahead. Do this by taking the first idea that comes into your head and making a quick prototype of the crap-up variety. Then think about what you have learned from this. If you're brave enough, try it out on some people and get their thoughts. In the D School, in our design programs at Stanford, prototyping is a way of life. The same is true for our neighbors, the design consultancy IDEO. Between Stanford and IDEO, I have seen thousands of prototyping examples. Most have been very useful, and some have become iconic. In my transformative design class, a 3-student team was interested in improving the patient experience in Stanford Hospital's emergency room. They were particularly interested in how patients in the waiting room were managed. They arranged to visit the emergency room to do patient observations and interviews. Unfortunately, a day before their visit, permission for their visit was revoked due to issues of patient privacy. Undeterred, the students thought up a prototype that worked like the emergency room system. They based their prototype on making the need to urinate analogous to the need for emergency medical treatment. They invited a group of friends and asked them to be sure not to have urinated for several hours. When their friends arrived, they offered them drinks and also denied them access to the bathroom. Eventually, the bathroom was opened. However, people wanting to use it had to sit in a special waiting area until they were called. The order of the call was not according to arrival time in the waiting area. It was according to how much a person had drunk. In the student's analogy, the more people drank, the greater their need for priority medical treatment, and thus those who had drunk the most were given earlier access to the bathroom. This prototype yielded important insights as to how to better inform patients and gain their understanding when they see others taken out of turn while waiting for service in a hospital emergency room. Prototyping like this gets you past the cerebral what it might be like stage and into the reality of problem solving. In another case, designers made a film to show how a proposed children's smartphone application would work. Using the app, kids would touch or flick the screen to animate creatures. The film demonstrated this by using a man in place of the creatures. Was the film made by recording the actual app on a smartphone? No. The prototype was simply a piece of cardboard in the shape of a phone screen, and there was a real person on the other side. The person would move in response to the user's hand as he pretended to touch the imitation phone screen. In this way, the designers could test and demonstrate various different ideas without the need to actually create the animated figure and the programs to control it. This led to Sesame Street's Elmo's Monster Maker, a very successful smartphone app for children. What is being prototyped in these examples is the basic idea, that is, the concept behind the eventual solutions. They fall under the broad heading of conceptual prototypes, as opposed to functional prototypes, which are made to test the actual functioning of the solution. Because prototypes can be physical objects, sketches, videos, conversations, or any trial balloon, the bottom line with prototyping is to choose the type that will let you learn the most in the fastest way. Prototyping has different purposes, depending on where we are in the solution process. Let's divide this process into three stages. In the first stage, we use prototyping to inspire a good concept. This is often called a concept prototype. The second stage is to concretely evolve the solution. This is a feasibility prototype. The final stage is to validate that the solution is actually going to work as expected. This is a functional prototype. What I've been talking about is mainly the first stage. As the solution process proceeds, the approximations to the final solution get more exact, and the prototypes tend to become more like dress rehearsals for the real thing. Even though we rarely think in these formal terms when dealing with personal issues, these same concepts about prototyping apply to most problems. For every issue you deal with, you need to be inspired to find a solution idea, evolve the details of a solution, and validate that the solution works. In everyday life, you may show a draft of a letter to someone or simply ask for advice about something you were thinking of doing. By doing this, you too are prototyping. It may be helpful to keep this in mind when you're facing a project you keep putting off. If you've long had an idea for a screenplay at the back of your mind, or if you want to design a dress, don't get caught up in how you're going to get it just right. That's what causes many people to shut down and never get started. Avoid the desire for perfection right out of the gate. Instead, tell yourself that you're prototyping your screenplay or your dress. The final version can come later. Keep your focus. In problem solving, as in all facets of life, sometimes things go very wrong. When they do go wrong, we tend not to take responsibility for our part in the malfunction. One common way of avoiding responsibility is to label the missteps as accidents. My main athletic activity is biking. I am extremely fortunate in being able to bike to work every day. I also have a group of friends that I ride with on Sundays, and several times a year we go on extended bike trips. This ritual has gone on for over 30 years, and in that time I have witnessed many bike accidents. Unfortunately, I too have had my share of spills. Looking back over all the accidents, I see that almost all of them have a single root cause: loss of focus. I, or someone, wasn't paying attention. My two worst bicycle accidents are classic examples. In the first, we had cycled over 30 miles from Stanford University to San Francisco. The plan was to take the train back home. When we got within sight of the train station, I felt the ride was over, and I started thinking about a presentation I was scheduled to make that evening. I was not paying attention to riding. Suddenly, my tires got trapped in a trolley track groove, and I fell, sprawling into the middle of a busy intersection. Luckily, I did not get hit by any vehicles, although I did get badly bruised and bloodied. If I had been paying attention, I could easily have steered to cross the rail groove at an angle, as the rest of my group did. After this incident, I resolved to always keep my focus on the road when I am biking. Fast forward a few years to my usual Sunday ride. One of the other riders was talking to me about his upcoming trip to India, and we were falling behind the rest of the group. As we ended the conversation, I wanted to recommend a change in his itinerary. Momentarily, I was unable to recall the name of that nice city south of Bangalore. I started pedaling faster to catch up to the group, thinking of India and searching my brain for the name I was forgetting. Suddenly, I hit what seemed like a 3-foot-high wall. My bike flipped 180 degrees, and I landed on my head and shoulders in the middle of the road. The rider I had been talking to immediately stopped the traffic, and eventually I was taken to the side of the road with a trashed helmet, a dislocated shoulder, and a bleeding head and face. Oh yes, the name of the city was Mysore. Sort of poetic justice, don't you think? The 3-foot wall I thought I'd crashed into was in reality a 3-inch-high triangular island to split the traffic at a 3-way intersection. I had cycled around that island without incident almost every Sunday for over 30 years. Yep, I had broken my vow not to lose focus. Keeping focus is important in many parts of your life. Even if you don't bicycle, it'll keep you safe. I am not just talking about driving cars, skateboarding, rollerblading, piloting an airplane, running, walking, or other forms of physical activity. This holds for all aspects of life. Just as you give life its meaning, you give all your activities their meaning. In addition to your physical activities, your emotional and intellectual activities also require your focus. If you don't focus on these, you may also hit the 3-foot-high wall, even if you have gone past it safely many times before. I cannot call such malfunctions accidents. It's not about you. We tend to inflate our own importance in other people's lives and actions, and this is another cause of things going wrong in problem-solving and other aspects of our lives. We need to realize that other people are not concerned about our hairstyle or what we are wearing. They are too busy worrying about themselves to take much notice of us. People are mainly preoccupied with their own careers and problems, not yours. In spite of this, many of us believe we are the principal cause of other people's actions. A more realistic model is implied by the phrase, "It's not about me." I often found that when I thought I was the cause of another person's behavior or mood, it turned out later that their actions had nothing to do with me. Even recently, I needed a reminder of this when I took a trip overseas. I had signed up to give a series of lectures in Santiago, and then to co-lead a 5-day workshop on a ship off the southern coast of Chile. My wife, Ruth, was not happy to be left alone for 2 weeks. Although I left feeling a bit uneasy, and our parting was strained, I was not overly concerned about her. As soon as I got to Chile, I sent her a series of emails. After 3 days with no response, I figured she was probably mad at me. So I phoned, thinking that speaking directly would be the best way to clear things up. She did not answer the phone. I left a voice message asking her to phone me. I repeated this 4 times. She did not return my calls. I felt sure she was mad at me. I phoned our son Elliot and asked him to call her. She always picks up his calls. When he reported that he, too, could not reach her, I started to get very concerned. I asked Elliot to contact Ruth's friends. Those he could reach did not know where she was. From a neighbor, he found out that her car was still in the carport. The neighbor went into our house and everything looked normal. However, there was no sign of Ruth. It was now a few hours before I was scheduled to fly south from Santiago to meet the ship. I had to decide whether to cancel the trip and fly home. Finally, at the last minute, Elliot found her. She was ill and had been taken to the hospital by a friend. Ruth had been sending us emails the whole time and wondering why no one was responding. She found out later that she hadn't been sending or receiving emails because she had not properly connected to the hospital's Wi-Fi system with her new smartphone. By the time I came back home, Ruth had returned to good health. She had not been mad at me. If I had remembered the mantra, "It's not about me," I could have avoided misunderstandings. Your turn. The next few times something happens where you think people's actions are related to what you did or did not do, tell yourself, "It's not about me." And then note how you feel, and if possible, check how they feel. Motivation. Motivation is at the heart of problem solving. I once returned to Stanford after spending about a month lecturing in China. I was standing in front of a classroom on the first day of the term, looking at a group of graduate students who were there shopping for which classes to take. It was my job to motivate them to sit through 10 weeks of lectures in my class. What went through my mind was an item on the questionnaire they would be asked to fill out at the end of the last class, which was, "On a scale of 1 to 5, does the teacher motivate me to do my best work?" In our system, it's up to the teacher to motivate the students. If I don't motivate them, I am not doing a good job. For the first time, it seemed absurd to me that I was supposed to motivate graduate students. During my trip to China, I had experienced people who were highly self-motivated to learn. There was a stark contrast between that experience and what I was seeing in my classroom. My China trip occurred shortly after the normalization of diplomatic relations between the People's Republic of China and the United States, and there was a great societal thrust in China to learn English. No matter what city I was in, every time I left my hotel, there would be people waiting outside wanting to practice English. I was enthralled by their eagerness to learn, and at times ended up sitting in the street correcting pronunciation while several people read aloud to me. Some years later, when I started participating in the Burning Man Festival, I was again struck by the power of self-motivation. I witnessed thousands of people who put in endless hours of labor, and in some cases lots of money, to create things that had no commercial value. They were doing it for self-satisfaction and the entertainment of their friends. They thought what they were making was cool, and they were proud to show it off. Again, I thought about this in contrast to my experience as a teacher. Education systems tend to use rewards as motivators. The most immediate reward is a grade. Once you get a certain number of those, you earn the system's ultimate reward, a degree. The problem with this is that the rewards are basically extrinsic, not intrinsic. Getting a degree for many students is highly instrumental. It is for them the same as if they were working all week at an odious job just to earn enough money to have fun on the weekend. The system does not give them the tools to be self-motivated. It may provide heroic role models, but unfortunately, for most students, these models represent an unattainable lifestyle that they can only worship from afar. No matter how high their grades, their education can leave them with a lack of focus, a lack of direction, and a lack of confidence. Many people who graduate are not sure they can do anything. The system is not geared toward fostering their growth to a point where they can develop intrinsic motivation. It often does not give them an opportunity to do something that matters to them and that they feel is actually important. I have found that project-based learning greatly increases intrinsic motivation. My experience with student motivation comes mainly from my experience at an elite university. In the years when we used to do the two-week creativity workshops, we would often hear, "Well, you can do that at Stanford, but you don't know how impossible that would be back at my school." After the first year, we found a way to answer that concern. Toward the end of the first week, we screened a movie called Stand and Deliver, based on the true story of a high school math teacher, Jaime Escalante. It shows how he succeeded in getting remarkable results by motivating underperforming, economically challenged students at Garfield High, a high school in the predominantly Hispanic ghetto of East Los Angeles. Everything was against Escalante. Initially, the school administration opposed him. The students had little family support. There were no positive role models, and the school had very limited resources. The main thing he had was his own motivation for his students' success. Determined to change the status quo, Escalante had to persuade the first few students who would listen to him that they could control their futures with the right education, and he enrolled them in a newly created calculus class. Ultimately, he was able to create a math program that, every year, turned out classes in which almost all the students passed the challenging Advanced Placement Calculus examination. The film is a tearjerker and worth seeing. It served our purpose of inspiring and motivating attendees in our workshop, and it will do the same for you. The message the workshop participants always came away with was, if Escalante could accomplish what he did in circumstances that were many times more difficult than anything I will ever face, then I cannot hide behind the excuse that my environment does not support what I want to accomplish. Be the cause in the matter. The Escalante story is not only about education, just as my experiences in China and at Stanford are not only about teaching. All these stories are about the human experience. They are relevant to all human interactions and all walks of life. They are relevant to your and my family situations, to a mom-and-pop business, to a startup, and to a large corporation. It does not matter what you do for a living, or what your job title is or is not. We all face these same issues of how to get the job done and live a satisfying life. Being the cause in the matter means taking full responsibility for whatever you're dealing with and whatever happens in your life, even when it seems that things are not totally in your control. It's a declaration of choice. Instead of playing the role of passive protagonist in your life, choose to take charge of your future. Resolve to get things done, whatever it takes, and no matter how many valid reasons pop up. On a long train ride in China, I noticed that the windows were dirty. I could have complained or sulked about it. Instead, I got out during a stop, got a bucket of water, and washed the windows. I decided to be the cause in the matter of my trip. If you're missing opportunities because you're waiting for someone else to act, consider how empowering it is to take responsibility for your own experiences. Even if we have never met, this book has been about you. By telling you my stories, I hope I am motivating you to look at your life in an honest and open way. Underpinning everything is my assumption that you are willing to examine your own experiences and make desired corrections to your future story. This book has offered many tools and concepts. They can only be of value to you if you are willing to give them a chance. Do not prejudge them. It doesn't matter if you think they are great or not. What matters is whether they prove to be valuable in your life. Adopt an attitude of willingness to give things a chance. Allow yourself to test things out and see what happens without thinking you know the outcome. To test things, you need to give them your attention. Attention begins with noticing your behaviors and interactions. Notice both yourself and the people you interact with. What works and what doesn't? What could work better? Then test the various tools and exercises in this book by inserting them into your everyday interactions. You can do one of them to start, and then add another. For example, notice how you and your friends use reasons. Then cut back on your use of reasons. Just say what you have to say without justifying it. Modify your way of speaking until you are practically reason-free. Next, notice how much of what you think and say is clearly a projection. Check yourself on projections. You do this by reversing subject and object in your thoughts or speech. Be aware of which version feels closer to the truth. The projection exercise will not work if you are not honest with yourself. When one of my students told me that the projection exercises did not work for him, I asked him for an example. He told me that reversing the following sentence did not work. I am listening to this boring speaker. He goes on and does not say anything. I asked him to change the subject and object. He came up with, he is listening to my boring talk. I go on and do not say anything. I asked the student if the reversal felt like it had some truth in it. He said no. There was an almost audible sound from the restrained smirks in the class. The other students could not have imagined he would say no. The projection seemed 100% accurate to all of us. This student regularly came to class ill-prepared, and to fake it, he would ramble on and on, repeating the same inane comments until I found a way to finally interrupt him. Clearly, he was not willing to tell himself the truth when he looked at the sentence reversal. It described his behavior perfectly. After I worked with him for a while, he smiled and admitted there might be something for him to think about in the projection exercise. Unfortunately, I will not be with you to assist you in being honest with yourself. You will need to do it for yourself. Believe me, the projection exercise works. If it doesn't work for you, chances are you are not willing to look at your truth. Attempt various slight variations in the wording. If it still doesn't work, imagine me standing behind you saying, tell yourself the truth. If that still doesn't work, imagine me standing behind you shouting, bullshit. After you get the hang of noticing your use of reasons and projections, move on to reducing the number of times you say, but, and start using, and, instead. Then move to some of the other exercises in this book. Informed by your insights and clear intentions, you can use the tools in this book to modify your behavior. Eventually, you will think you are getting perfect. That's when you need to start looking at the exercises all over again. Go back to square one and keep fixing yourself. It will keep you busy until you die. It's best to think of the material in this book as a tonic that you need to keep taking, or at least as a seasonal dose. Much like an annual flu shot. One shot will not inoculate you for life. I speak from personal experience. I was on sabbatical leave in Sweden. During the day, I was leading workshops on creativity and problem solving, using many of the techniques described in this book. At night, I was losing sleep, wondering about whether I should retire because I was about to reach what was then the normal retirement age. In the middle of one of the sessions, I realized I had not applied what I was teaching to my own problem. That evening, I asked myself, what would it do for me if I retired? The answer was, I could stop worrying about whether I should retire. In a flash, I realized I had spent 6 months thinking about the wrong problem. I now had the real question. How do I stop worrying about whether to retire? The answer was obvious. Stop thinking about it. Now, over 15 years later, I can tell you that since that evening, I have never once thought about retiring. I feel really stupid that I wasted 6 months on something I didn't really care about, and that I was doing it while I was teaching others how to deal with the right question. Be smarter than I was. Realize that your mind is trickier than you think, and is always working with your ego to make you believe you are doing better than you really are. That's the human condition. What you have going for yourself is that, if you choose to, you can be mindful about controlling both your intentions and your attention to make your life better for yourself and for those around you. You can choose to be the cause in the matter of the circumstances of your life, and you can instill in yourself the habit of achievement for a more functional and satisfying life. I hope this book contributes to those worthy goals. This is Sean Pratt. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of The Achievement Habit, Stop Wishing, Start Doing, and Take Command of Your Life by Bernard Roth. This program was produced by Common Mode. Paul Fowley, Technical Director. Executive Producer, Katie Estroka. Text copyright 2015 by Bernard Roth. Production copyright 2015 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.